Go Queen Linda.
Hambone, hambone, where you been? Round the corner and back again. Mm-hmm. Hambone, hambone, where you was? Oh, yeah. In the kitchen cooking rice. Hambone.
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 Give me hambone. Give me some hambone.
Hambone.
Well, now, hambone, hambone, put him on your shoulder. Mm-hmm. If you get a pretty girl, I'll show you how to hold her. Mm-hmm. Hambone, hambone, where you been? All around the world and back again. Hambone.
Hambone.
Hambone. Hambone.
Hambone.
Crazy hambone.
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 Hambone. Hambone. Hambone.
Queen Linda talking about the ham bone. Mm-hmm. Said now ham bone, what you gonna do? Got in a train and my fella flew.
Come
said ham bone, where did you go?
Yeah.
To Miss Lucy,
I tell
door.
A story now.
Miss Lucy, would you marry me? Well, I don't care if Papa don't care. Ham bone,
ham bone.
Welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that was Amakayla's Hambone being from her Being in Love CD. I'm sure she has another out by now. But anyway, that's a great, great tune off a great album. We are going to be talking to Getty Feline-Cohen about the annual African Film Festival at the Pacific Film Archive at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And that starts tomorrow, and there are some wonderful films in the lineup, one of which is Mother of George, and I don't know if you remember the interview that I had with the director, because that film had a theatrical debut. But it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful series, and we're looking forward to talking to her. But in the meantime, I'm going to play something else. I was trying to think, by whom? I have so many things, so many wonderful songs to choose from. But I want to make a couple of announcements really quickly while we have a moment. Got a chance to see Lynn Stewart, the wonderful radical lawyer who was in prison. She actually got compassionate release and got a chance to see her when I was in Newark for Baba Mary Baraka's homegoing last week. So it was really a wonderful tribute to him, and got a chance to see her at a dinner that happens every year that was put on by the Fergusons, and they were honored as well. And so the dinner is for political prisoners and their families and prisoners of war. So it's just a wonderful gathering, and Lynn Stewart was there. She looks great. She needs some help with her medical bills, so the Bay Area is going to have a benefit for her next week. So let me read you the announcement. So it's Wednesday. The celebration of Lynn's liberation and the benefit for her ongoing medical care is Wednesday, January 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. It's at 1015 Folsom Street between 6th and 7th Street in San Francisco. And the venue requires participants to be at least 21 years of age. So it's not for all. It's not for the whole family, just for those who are legally adults. And a special feature of this benefit is that there's going to be a live report from Lynn Stewart via Skype, so you'll be able to talk to her. And there's going to be refreshments, food, and beverages. The suggested donation is $20, but no one is turned away. And to RSVP, you can RSVP by emailing mya.shone@gmail.com. And if you can't attend, you can send donations by check or money order to Lynn Stewart, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, Organization, 1070 Dean, D-E-A-N Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11216. And again, that's Lynn Stewart Organization, 1070 Dean Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11216. And again, next week, the event is January 29th, Wednesday, 6 to 9, 1015 Folsom Street between 6th and 7th Street in San Francisco. So that should be wonderful. And there's some other things going on besides the African Film Festival, and I will make those announcements a little later. Dance Brigade is opening its latest production, Hemorrhage, and we're going to have Chrissy Kiefer on a little bit later on in the show to talk about that. And Miss Pat's House is inviting the Voodoo Queen to visit, and that's going to be on Sunday, this Sunday, at La Pena Culture Center in Berkeley. And we're going to have Yaya Tish, Louisa Tish, and Javelin Richards on to talk about that, and that's going to be wonderful. And who else is going to be? Oh, and there's a wonderful science fair tomorrow in East Palo Alto, and we're going to have the director of that particular project is going to be on the air shortly after this interview to talk about that. And let's see. That's the show. It's going to be pretty fantastic, if I do say so myself. So let me put on another song, and then see where our guest is. We're going to play. Thinking about playing Bookman Experience. This is for our ancestors, because Mary Rudge, poet laureate for Alameda, the city of Alameda, she made her transition last week. I heard about it Monday. Upesi, Umtambisu, she made her transition last year, late last year. Brother Yusuf Al-Wajid, wonderful artist, creator of wood, creator out of wood, wonderful father, longshoreman, retired longshoreman. He made his transition this month. Amiri Baraka, of course, mentioned him already. He made his transition this month. Let's see, anyone else? Gosh, the list is just growing. And we want to, you know, honor them. So this particular piece from Bookman Experience, Zanset Nu Yu, I don't do Creole, so it translates as our ancestors. And this is also remembering the ancestors, those that died during that horrific earthquake in Haiti.
We're going to salute our ancestors from Africa, from America, from Chelsea, from India, all positive vibrations to help us. Sunset New York.
Congo, Congo, by an ever Congo.
that was Bookman Experience performing there. I don't know how to pronounce it, but the person who's on the air, Getty Feline Cohen, does. I was killing the Creole for our ancestors, so I'm not going to even try.
Thank you for playing Bookman.
Oh, yeah.
I'm good, and you, Wanda?
Oh, I'm fine. I just like, wow. And then I realized, oh, you know, I got somebody from IET, you know, that's going to be on the show. Like, oh, this is just perfect. Yeah, and we have such a sad anniversary, you know, of the earthquake this month. Yeah, and but your film.
What's anniversary? 4 years already.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it amazing? It's been like, wow.
I
mean, it's amazing in that so much hasn't happened. Yeah. And, you know, but your wonderful work is just fantastic. You're born in Port-au-Prince and reared in America and came of age cinematically in Paris, France. So you're a global woman. you are an award-winning, Getty Feline, you're an award-winning Haitian-American filmmaker with a very eclectic and rich background in the film and television industry. And you are you the programmer or one of the programmers for Pacific Film Archives and bringing to us the annual African Film Festival, which we are so excited about?
I'm excited too. No, I'm not the programmer. I am a guest spokesperson, I guess we can say. I think Kathy Gerrits, who programs the festival, reached out to me because I have a film at the festival this year that I'm distributing, which is Tay Today by Alain Gomis, which stars Saul Williams, which is playing at the festival, and she reached out to me to, because I know all the films and I have a deep connection with the African Film Festival. I've known Mahen for the longest time, who is, you know, instrumental in bringing African cinema for the last 20 years to America, and also shaping the careers of so many of those filmmakers that are, you know, showing their films there at the festival at the PFA. And so she asked me if I wanted to be the spokesperson for the festival, and I said yes. That's kind of like the way that it was done. I rarely say no, so.
That's so wonderful. So why don't you tell us about Tay, the film that you're distributing, and then we can talk about some of the other highlights of this wonderful
Okay. Well, Tay is a third feature length by Alain Gomis, who is Senegalese, French Senegalese. His mother's French, his father's from Senegal. Actually, his father's from Guinea-Bissau, but migrated to the south of Senegal. So he really feels like he's from like these different parts of like Africa and Europe. And actually, he won the FESPACO for best film last year. It was the first time that Senegal won that prize. And Saul Williams won for best actor. It was the first time a non-African actor won for best actor. And he hates it when I say non-African, but, you know, not born on the African continent. And the film has been to, like, over 50 festivals and has won, like, over 24 prizes. It was, you know, on the short list for the Golden Globes. It's been all over the world, actually, and it's a beautiful piece. It really takes place in one day, and it spans the life of a man who's spending his last day on Earth. It's a wonderful poetic tale, you know, that takes place in the mythical place, but we know that it's, you know, in Dakar, because that's the city where the film was shot in. And I'm showing on February 5th. But I'm so excited about the program in general, because it just spans, like, you know, all across the continent. We have like films from Algeria, from Nigeria also, because it takes place in New York, which is Mother of George. That's the film that the festival opens with, and that's Andrew Dusselmuth's film, and that opens on the 25th, and I think a lot of people know about this film because it had a very selected release in the United States, lots of great critical praise. It tells the story of a woman who's a Nigerian couple trying to have a child, and until the mother-in-law gives her, like, a very unorthodox way to get pregnant.
Yeah, we had an interview with the director, and the film is just, it's so lovely. It's, I mean, cinematically, it's so beautiful. Oh, my goodness. Isn't it a gorgeous film?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's very stylized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Andrew is, Andrew is a photographer by trade, and he's been, you know, like, I mean, like, images are really important to him, and the style and the colors, everything is important to him. And the film, you know, like, there are moments of the film that looks like a painting, you know, that looks, you know, like, it looks like you're seeing a series of, like, you know, paintings, you know, from, like, the Dutch era, almost. I mean, those colors are just so vibrant and beautiful.
Yes, they are. Yeah, let's talk about some of the other films. You wanted to talk about Nairobi Half-Life, and I just watched Bernadette Durasa, and Zarafa is the beautiful short that I told you about. Let's talk about some of the films, some other of the films.
Yeah, Bernadette Jessa is a really funny film, because when you start it, you don't know what you're watching. You think you're watching a documentary, and you're sort of like kind of like displaced and everything. And so it's a fresh new kind of form, you know, for Africa, because it's usually very, you know, stories, you know, like that are very typical, you know, about like, you know, generational rift and so on and so forth. And so this is a sort of like an almost kind of documentary, the way that it's filmed. And then you realize that you're in a fiction, like maybe 10 minutes in, but it's okay. You're not lost. You're there. You're following, because it opens up with this kind of like narrator, you know, and it's I love the style. I love the form, and it's pretty powerful. It's a pretty powerful story.
Yes.
You know, it's got great characters, and that's like, you know, that's, for me, it was the first time I had seen a film like that from the continent, and that using that kind of form and very, very, like, very mobile camera, you know, in your face kind of camera movements. I think people are going to really be discovering lots of treats at the festival. I love also Nairobi Half-Life.
Yeah, before we go to Nairobi, let's talk a little bit more about this one. Just mentioning that it's from Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, 2012, and it's a hip-hop film. And so there's a lot of, you know, sort of really gritty, wonderful, you know, sort of music and the colors, and it's dark and then it's light. And it's also maybe even sort of kind of epic, particularly the last scene.
Yeah.
See the brother walking down the street. I'm like, ooh,
I was the whole time I was watching the film, I was having like these, you know, I was going back and forth. I was very ambivalent about the film. I love the structure and everything, but I was kind of like ambivalent about it. And at the end, it really stayed with me. It really did. And like you say, that scene when he walks and, you know, with the bloody, he's stained undershirt, and he's walking, and it's like day is rising. And that's such a beautiful shot. I love that. I love that shot. It really stays. It really stays with you.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just thinking about the narrator.
Yeah. And the music in there is really interesting too. The moments, the musical moments in the film are really interesting.
Mhm. Yeah, and in that last scene, you know, I think the narrator is Lonesome Solo, aka Suleiman Bamba, because he tells the story, and you're right, I don't know what this is about. I think we're gonna go into I think it's a short, and then it's like, you know, he's prefacing the story, and then he inserts himself, and then we see him in the scene because he was there when it happened.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
It's like the Greek chorus, you know? Except that, but he's alone, so he's like this, and he's this lonesome narrator.
Some desolate place we don't know where.
Exactly. It's like a no man's land, you know? I totally loved it.
Yeah. Okay, now you could talk about Nairobi Half-Life, because I know you love that one.
Well, you know, I like all the films, but there's some of them that really, really stay with you, but for like several reasons. And Nairobi Half-Life for me is just a gem, because it's it's, you know, the story is not that extremely original. It's about, you know, this guy from a village and who moves to, you know, like, who wants to go to the city to, you know, like, to achieve his dream of an actor. But mm-hmm. he is such a wonderful character, and he's just mm-hmm. so beautiful to look at, and he's just, and he goes through all these, like, trials and tribulations and still keeps his humanity and dignity, and it's just, and the acting is so wonderful, the lighting, the editing, I mean, for a first film, I was blown over. At first, I was kind of like, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, it's going to be one of those kind of, like, you know, shoot 'em up kind of, you know, like, gangster style, copying American style filmmaking. Not at all, because I had seen the trailer, and the trailer for me was giving me, like, a different feel. It was giving me a feel like, okay, this is, like, copying, like, you know, Boys in the Hood or something like that. And I don't like it when I see films that are made, like, outside of America that look like films, you know, like, that look like American films that, you know, people are trying to make so they can, like, you know, find acceptance of, you know, from American viewers. Not at all. It was just, I have seen things in there that I had never seen before. It feels very much like The Harder They Come, you know, Perry Hensel's film, you know, and that grittiness of it. But it is really, really extremely well done, but on every level. I was blown over with that film. And David Tosh, the director, is a cinematographer, actually, and so that's how he makes his living, you know, in Nairobi. He lives and works in Nairobi, and he does, like, you know, he does, like, art direction and cinematography for other films, and this is his first film, and he's working on his next one right now, but it was, like, it was amazing. I loved it, and I think the festival this year really shows, like, you know, all the, like, young, you know, new generation of, like, African filmmakers, and it's just, like, something for everybody. I don't know what, you know, like, I can't tell people, I mean, like, I can't choose, you know, I'd go and see them all, and then it's a series of shorts, you know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I think I saw Nairobi Half-Life at the Zanzibar International Film Festival last summer, and yeah, I'm sure I did, and yeah, it was really wonderful. And I think the director was there, but I'm not certain. But yeah, it's a film that's full of surprises because you don't know what's going to happen, so it keeps you on the edge of your seat, which is really great.
You don't. You're hoping that he'll make it, you know, but you don't know because it's just
because it turns on,
you know, like, yeah, because it becomes, you know, really, like, dark, you know, at some mm-hmm. point, and you don't know, and so you're sitting at the edge of your seat, and you really go inside of his skin, and I love that. I love when I'm watching a film and I become, like, the character. I love also watching a film at a distance and really, like, following with the person, but I love also becoming that character, and I think David does that very well in his film, where he puts you in the character's place and going through some, like, really, like, you know, tricky moments of, like, what decision would you make, you know, and Alain Gomis does that also with Tay, with using Saul Williams as the lead role, because you're sitting at the edge of your seat, you know, going, okay, what's going to happen here? It's not a tense film at all, but you're kind of like, you know, someone told me that, you know, for them, Tay was kind of like a thriller, because the whole time they know that this guy's spending his last day, and they're like, okay, when is it going to happen? How is it going to happen, you know? And then at some point, you got to let go and just live his last day with him, basically. And and I think that's what Alain wants everyone to do, is basically just kind of, like, go through it. You know, like, what if it were your last day? What would you do, you know?
Right, yeah. And the Nairobi Half-Life, at the Zanzibar International Film Festival, they were highlighting young filmmakers and new film out of Kenya, specifically, mm-hmm. but also East Africa. And so there was, like, I think they call them Bamba films. And so there was like a series of films, I mean, that were like this. It's a genre that Nairobi Half-Life is a part of, and they were simply fantastic. And one of those films actually, I think, got Best Mention or something on the award tonight. You said you didn't get a chance to see Zarafa, a film that I really loved, And it's actually a film that the whole family will enjoy. It's recommended for ages 7.
It's an animated film.
Sunday afternoon, February 2nd, which is next week. And it is a wonderful film that moves from Africa to Europe and then France and then back, and it's set in Sudan, and it looks at the Arab slave trade and this wonderful young boy Maki who befriends a giraffe and makes a promise to the giraffe's mother, and in the meantime there's like a love story that develops, and it's just really, really wonderful.
I read a lot about it. It's just that it hasn't been in the same spaces that I've been in, and I haven't seen it. So I'm so excited that it's, you know, that it was programmed at the festival. I really encourage like whole families to come out and see. There's some great animated films coming out of the continent as well. I mean, this one is actually. I mean, the lead animator is the Belgian animator who did Les Triplettes de Belleville, which was a very, very popular film, which did extremely well at the box office. And so the animation is very similar. I've seen excerpts of the film, and it's just so beautiful. And it's just a very, very compelling story. This is definitely the one for the entire family to come out. But a lot of these films, a lot of these films are very much open to like all kinds of public. There aren't any. I mean, in terms, a Nairobi Half-Life, I don't know if you should take your 5-year-old, but otherwise, I think they're great for school students as well. High school students to come out and see these films. Because it's really showing the continent in a different light, but through the lenses of like African filmmakers, which is really interesting. I think it's been a really great year for Black films in general. I have never seen that. It was just kind of like, I was ecstatic in 2013 with all the great Black films that were coming out, even in America, with Fruitvale, Ryan Coogler's film, and then we had The Butler, we had the oversimplification of her beauty, just so many wonderful films that were coming out, along with these films coming out from the continent. So there's just so much going on.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and then I really liked 12 Days a Slave, that film about Samuel Northrup. I thought that was a really well done. And that was a diaspora Pan-African collaboration, because the writer is African-American, but he's living in Europe. The director is Afro Brit, and it's just like, and the actors
Caribbean,
are from
and the
actors are from the African diaspora, like the continental as well as elsewhere. So it's a real, real collaboration. That particular film.
There's a lot of that in all of those films here as well. In this film, in this at the festival, because Andrew's film, for example, take Andrew's film. There, he's got like Nigerian. He's got Senegalese. He has like a Haitian. He has Emeline Michel, who plays the role of the actress's mom, the female character's mom, and Emeline Michel is Haitian. There's so much room to sort of like to collaborate that way, And his DP is Bradford Young, and who's like this, African American, just like this on the rise, cinematographer. Everyone wants to work with him. He did Pariah. He did Ava DuVernay's film Middle of Nowhere. He did Restless City before that with Andrew. And so it's just a lot of like great collaboration going on as well. We didn't talk about Jean-Pierre Bécolo, who's making his comeback with the film Le Président.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I wanted you to mention that. Our other guest is in the green room, but let's end with because that's Tuesday the 28th, and also I actually got a chance to see Fueling Poverty, which opens that particular program, which is a beautiful film. Ishaya Bako out of Nigeria, with music by Femi Kuti and Asha. It's a really beautiful film that looks at. It's a documentary that looks at. Sort of the frauds and history around why Nigeria is so poor when it produces more oil you know, than any other country. And he talks about the oil subsidy funds, which is really interesting. I hadn't known about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and the title is just so beautiful, Fueling Poverty, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, great play on words. Talk about the president.
I haven't seen that documentary. I heard a lot about it. It's on my list to come out and see it as well. And I would urge people to come and see it if they want to know more about what's going on in Nigeria in terms of like the history of Nigeria as well, because it really goes in depth into that whole history of how Nigeria became like this really rich country, which at the same time is fueling a lot of poverty. But Jean-Pierre Bekele's film is a kind of documentary fiction, and it could take place just anywhere. It's just like it's an amazing, you know, it's an amazing tableau of like of different actors and different styles and forms. And I've been excited to like, you know, to see Jean-Pierre's new films, because I have not seen a film from him since Quartier Musa. Which is, that's what you call it also in English. I didn't see Les Seignantes, and it's kind of like a comeback for him, because we haven't seen like a film by Bekele in quite a while. And he made it with Cameroon and got funds from Germany. That's the way a lot of these filmmakers fund their films as well. You know, it's funding is always an issue for everyone. But it's so great to have a festival like this, you know, that really gives a platform to these films, you know, and that Kathy is still going and still pushing for these films, you know.
Right.
I think it's just going to get even better, you know, as like more great films come from the continent, you know. So we should be looking forward to this festival like every year.
Right, cool. Yeah, so let's tell people about, you know, how they can get tickets. The African Film Festival 2014 is Saturday, January 25th through Wednesday, February 26th. And the UC Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive is, the Pacific Film Archive Theater is located at 2575 Bancroft Way in Berkeley. For information, you can call 510-642-1124, 510-642-1124. And for tickets, you can call 510-642-5249, 652-5249. And you can also get tickets online at bampfa.berkeley.edu, http://, after the colons, bampfa.berkeley.edu. And general admission is $9.54, one program, $13.54 double bills. And for children and students and faculty and staff is $5.50 and $9.50. And for other students, young people, 13 to 17, and disabled person is $6.50 and $10.50. So it's kind of affordable compared to other places. And it's definitely a treat because, you know, it's easier to go to PFA than to travel to the continent to see these great films. So you definitely want to make sure you catch them all, because they're all different and they're all wonderful. And this is just such a wonderful time of the year. African Film Festival hits Berkeley and the Bay Area. So wonderful.
And it is like traveling to the continent, because you have films from like Ivory Coast, you know, from Nigeria, from Senegal, Cameroon. I mean, it's like, Algeria. You know, it's like traveling to the continent. It's really getting a very good taste, you know, of the continent through this
yeah.
program. I love this program.
Yeah, cool. Well, thank you so much, Getty, for joining us this morning. And, looking forward to seeing you in the movies.
Thank you for having me. You will be seeing me.
All right. You take good care.
All right. Take care.
Enjoy your walk
Bye-bye.
Today. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. You're welcome. Bye. Good morning, Chris. Thanks so much for hanging in there.
Good morning.
We're speaking to Chris Norwood, founder and president of the Bay Area Tooting Association, speaker, mentor in innovation lecture, and he's going to be telling us about a wonderful program tomorrow. So why don't you tell us about the program first, and then I'll come back and read your bio.
Sure, no problem. Good morning.
Good morning,
Wanda. Thank you very much for providing this opportunity to speak about and spread the word on the 12th annual Dr. Frank S. Green Scholars Program Science Fair. is being held this Saturday, tomorrow, in the South Bay, San Jose, at Cypress Semiconductor in San Jose, California. The agenda is that over 100 scholars of African and African-American descent will be displaying science fair projects using the scientific methodology in preparation for regional and national competitions with a better known or a more publicized event called Synopsis Science Fair. The judging for the event will occur from 9 a.m. to noon, and the event, and the event will be opened up to the public from 1 p.m. or 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m.
Yeah. So tell us the type of entries you've had over the years, and this is a preparation for another affair, which I'm not aware of. I don't know that one. And where is that one? Is that also in San Jose, the one that a lot of these participants also enter their projects into?
So it's interesting. The Synopsis Science Fair is a international science fair, and it has regional competition. But what is come from the founder of the Green Scholars Program, Dr. Deborah Watkins, and the executive director, or the program director, Gloria Whitaker Daniels, is this emphasis on children of African and African American descent understanding, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, you know, commonly known as STEM projects. And so one of the events that has been going on for many, many years is the Synopsis Science Fair. They have regional competitions, then those regionals turn into national, and then the national turns into international. And so what the Green, Dr. Frank S. Green Scholars Program does with this science fair is it nurtures along a group of students from early as third grade through 12th grade on an ongoing basis on the scientific methodology of science fairs. So this weekend, in San Jose, held at Cypress Semiconductor, will be the 12th annual science fair for Dr. Frank S. Green and the Green Scholars Program. In years past, I mean, me personally as a parent, as well as a participant in the organization, has been blown away with some of the science experiments these young scholars have created, called seeing which fruit has the most DNA, what is the best material to build an expansion bridge, do sound waves created by different genres of music affect the growth of bacteria? How does body chemistry affect how are the pheromones affect how a perfume or cologne smells on a person? Based on rating and type, can video games have dire effects on human health? I mean, these are just some of the past experiments that I remember. And again, each year, it is amazing with the projects that these scholars come up with as far as preparing for the science fair. One of the neat things that are going to be happening this year is that it is in a contest format, and these students will be vying for over $5,000 in cash and prizes for the winning science fair projects.
Okay. So how many of the students from last year, let's say, went on to the Synopsis one?
I believe approximately around 10% moved on to the Synopsis Fair. Part of it is that in there is a limited amount of science or science fair activity exposed to these kids. And so what they're getting used to now is the rigor of creating these science fair projects and moving on to compete at the national and international levels. Years ago, we've had students in the Green Scholar Science Circle all the way to the championship level, the national championship level. So it's a very, very rigorous process. It's taxing on the students, but each year when the students come back as members of the Green Scholars Program, you can see their academic, mental, emotional, and presentation growth. And that's part of the overall rigor and the, you know, the vision for the Dr. Frank S. Green Scholars Program.
Right. Well, since this is your 12th annual, that means that you have students that have probably gone on to college and finished. So of the participants in the science fair, can you give us some names of students who have matriculated through higher education and what they're doing now around science?
There are two that I can name right offhand.
Okay.
That are very, very close to the program, and that's Catherine Daniels. She's one of the students, and now she's a junior executive at a biotech organization. Recently graduated from USC, mm-hmm. And there is. I just threw a blank. My list right here. I'm just kind of trying to get through it a little bit. I can tell you this, that 100% of the students that have participated in the mm-hmm. Green Scholars Program have gone on to college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right that 90% graduate from college in 4 years, and nearly 40% of the students participating in the Green Scholars Program graduate from college with degrees preparing them for STEM careers, which is nearly five times the national average for students of African ancestry, which is wonderful. So can you tell us a little bit about Dr. Frank S. Green and why he decided to, or I don't know, did he start the Scholars Program, or did you all name it after him in honor of him?
No, so Deborah Watkins, the founder of the CAAAE, and who has a long history, Stanford graduate, who has a long history in the area, educator on in from San Jose Eastside Junior High School District, and just advocate, passionate advocate for, again, children of African and African American descent. She started the Dr. Frank S. Green Scholars Program, named after. Dr. Green, he was one of her longtime mentors. He was a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, philanthropist, in the times when, Hewlett-Packard was being launched. So when you think about the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, in a number of cases, you're familiar with folks that started HP, Apple, and companies of that nature, but sometimes you don't know the other people that were participants in that entire movement as well, and Dr. Frank S. Green was one of them.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, this is really, really wonderful. And I was going to ask you about the presence of young black women in the program, and then you mentioned that one of the people you remember, you know by name, who has graduated and still close to the program, Catherine Daniels, you answered my question. So, do you know tomorrow, like already, how many of the participants are women, or young women, I should say, and how many are young men right now? Boys and girls?
So the other name, and she's the older sister, is Christina Daniels, and she graduated from Pomona. No, not Pomona. They're going to kill me. But I believe it was Pomona in Southern California, and she completed her degree, and she's moving on to the doctorate level for her education.
Good for her. Nice. That's excellent.
So when we look at the proportion or ratio of students in the program, it's roughly equal. Each year there's a waiting list for the program, as you can imagine, because it's the only program like it in the South Bay when it comes to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And so there's a committee that, weighs applications, and we make sure that the mix of, male to female is proportionate so that we have the opportunity to expose, these children to just an opportunity of living in the Bay Area as well as the Silicon Valley. So the proportions are just about equal between male and female.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's really awesome. Yeah. Well, let me tell our audience a little bit about you, because I haven't read your bio to them yet. You are an education innovator, innovation leader, and you've held technology and innovation leadership positions in both private and public sectors. You mesmerize audiences from a very young age by speaking on local and national platforms on the history of civil rights to the evolution of Common Core educational standards. You have a unique approach to informing professionals and empowering parents, inspiring teachers, and motivating students. Your style and ability to connect with these various audiences is dynamic and approachable. As a pioneer in the Bay Area hip-hop and rap movement, you were also an early adopter during the dot-com boom. You joined Alcom Corporation startup, leading their technical services and product management team. I guess this afforded you the opportunity to fine-tune your public speaking skills by conducting thoughtful leadership and technical training seminars in the United States and globally, including Canada, UK, or United Kingdom, Germany, France, Korea, and Australia.
Wanda, thank you. Thank you very much for some of the history of the things that I've been involved with and done. But it's just the opportunity to participate with the Green Scholars Program and the work that, you know, you're doing to educate. I listened to the earlier part of the show about the film festival in Berkeley, and I was like, man, I didn't know about that. I have to kind of get that on my radar, or even look to expose a number of the Green Scholar children to the event, because there's over 100 students, third grade through 12th grade, participating in the science fair. So we have third graders preparing science fair projects. Another aspect of the Green Scholar Science Fair is that now, over the past couple of years, the Silicon Valley technical community, African-American otherwise, is getting wind of this event. The host of the event has been a longtime advocate of the Green Scholars Program, Cypress Semiconductor. They have an amazing facility, and they allow the Green Scholars Program, which is a program underneath the California Alliance of African-American Educators, use their facility on a monthly basis. I mean, access to AV equipment, to full conference rooms, to just a run of a portion of their campus, so that these kids have the opportunity to see and be comfortable in, a corporate type of culture. It's, again, if it weren't for the vision of Deborah Watkins, the support of leadership such of organizations such as Cypress Semiconductor, the matriculation of what's going on wouldn't be where it is today. There'll be judges from Intel, IBM, Google, SanDisk, NASA, from all of the Oracle, all over the Bay Area. These corporate tech giants are either sponsoring, in one way or another, through scholarship, through in-kind resources, or even judges. They're coming out to the science fair to, one, be amazed at what these children are doing, but also to judge them critically as far as in preparation, for the opportunity to compete on the national or the regional and national level.
Yeah. I want to go back to your bio, though.
okay.
You're the founder of the Bay Area Tutoring Association, and you have a degree in a Bachelor's of Science degree, from William Jessup University, which is formerly San Jose Christian College, and then your own children, are 12 and 9, and you coach girls, boys after school, boys and girls basketball. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your Bay Area Tutoring Association and how that intersects with the scholars program. I mean, are you preparing some of these young people to be able to participate in this wonderful fair?
So what we do at the Bay Area Tutoring Association is that we train a culturally diverse group of tutors. We empower parents to have a better understanding of how to help their children navigate the school system. We create after-school culturally rich programs that involve math, science, English language arts. And for the Green Scholars Program, what we've been doing the past 3 years, on some instances, we provide SAT prep services. We help those students that we do provide private tutoring services. But the biggest thing that we're working towards now is helping parents prepare for what's commonly known as the Common Core State Standards. Mm-hmm. 45 states and several territories have adopted Common Core State Standards. And basically what those are is that across 45 different states, they've all agreed that they are going to equal the platform or attempt moved in the direction of equaling the platform of academic rigor across these 45 different states. So what that means is that not that necessarily the same subjects are going to be taught in the same way, but the Common Core State Standards basically state, here is what these children need to know when they graduate high school. And the reason for the movement to the Common Core State Standards, or the move, is because, you know, we're a nation in transition. On the global level, we are not at the top when it comes to mathematics and science and English language arts. We're no longer at the top, and America is making a concerted effort to say, let us work towards, you know, restoring our leadership in academics, you know, as we move forward into the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So why don't you give our audience information on how they could be in touch with you in your organization, just in case they want you to come in and, you know, and do something in their area around, you know, tutor training and, you know, and developing programs that are, socially and culturally relevant to their student population.
For sure. We have a website up, a very simple website that provides the basics, www.bayareatutor.org. That's www.bayareatutor.org. There's a message right there in the middle. What are you interested in? Do you want to tutor? Do you need a tutor? Would you like to partner with us here? Or we are a 501c3 organization. Would you like to donate? And once anyone goes to that website and provides their information, we can have a discussion, and we'll also provide them more detailed information on what we do and how we do it. And as a part of the association, or as the founder of the association, I realize that, you know, in one way or another, we've all had a tutor. We may not realize it. I commonly tell kids that, you know, they may think a tutor is for, you know, someone who doesn't understand something. I'm like, nope, if you're a big brother or a sister, you're a tutor. If you're a manager at work, you're a tutor. But they're typically not called, you know, tutors. They're called managers. If you're a sports coach, you're a tutor. They're typically not called the term tutor because it's affiliated with academics. But in reality, we're all tutors to one person or another in some form, shape, or fashion. Finally, kind of coming back to your point, the Green Scholars Program, what we also do for them is we do their summer math academy. We prepare them for programs such as what's going on in Oakland. There's a group called Level Plainfield Institute. They have a SMASH Academy. So we, in some instances, we help prepare students to take the SMASH Academy exam. So, again, we look to provide services, culturally relevant relationships, so that students understand, one, that although there are individuals that don't look like me, but we're all going to work together for the common good so that we can continue to move this nation forward in a prosperous manner.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let our audience know we're speaking to Chris Norwood about the Dr. Frank S. Green Scholars Program. of which he is one of the collaborating organizations. And it's the 12th Annual Green Scholars Program Science Fair. It's tomorrow, Saturday, January 25th. The judging is from 9 to 1. So unless you're a judge, you should show up from 1:30 to 3 and look at these wonderful, wonderful exhibits that these young people from grades 3rd through 12th have developed for this wonderful showcase. And it's a free event, and it's at the Cypress Semiconductor, 198 Champion Court in San Jose. And let's see. And again, Chris Norwood can be reached at greenscholars1@gmail.com, G-R-E-E-N-E, scholars, the number one, at gmail.com. Do you want to give your number?
Yes. If I may be reached at 510-792-1614, that's 510-792-1614. And any of all the people in the audience listening, if you have the opportunity to come out and inspire the next generation of leaders by seeing the work that they've done, the hands of the parents who have helped oversee these projects over the last several weeks, because none of the students or parents have formal training in doing science fair. So the houses are in chaos in preparation for this, because they're passionate about being able to display, you know, their best work in front of the community.
That's really wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and looking forward to staying in touch.
Thank you very much, Wanda. I really appreciate it.
All right. You take good care, and have a great time tomorrow discovering, you know, sort of what these scientists have you know, put together for this contest.
Yes. Thank you very, very much. You have a great day.
Right. You too. Bye-bye. Peace and blessings. Bye. We are joined by Chrissy Kiefer. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. Thank you.
I'm so happy that you could join us the day of the opening.
I know, right?
Hammer.
The morning.
Like,
oh.
Yeah. I'm learning. I'm like, when Stella said you could, I'm like, wow, she is good.
Yeah, I can. Here I am, 9 o'clock in the morning. Let's do it.
Yeah. So you got a new Dance Brigade show. It runs for 3 weeks with 11 performances total, and Stella says that you're turning the theater upside down, literally, and you're super excited about the set. In addition to the content, it looks at the current crisis of world affairs by focusing on the connection between gentrification, global warming, war, racism, and a continued attack on the rights of women, and use the backdrop of the Mission District and the onslaught of evictions to explore the connection of these current events via your hair trigger analysis. So, tell us, like, yeah, that's so intriguing. Hemorrhage, and then the title, hemorrhage. Like,
bleeding. I know, the title, yes, hemorrhage.
Yeah, that sounds urgent. An evolution of hope and despair.
Yeah, okay. It is urgent. I think that's what we're feeling right now, especially if you live in the Mission, you know, because it's sort of ground zero for the gentrification that's happening in San Francisco, you know, and I'm a long time Mission resident. I've lived on and off in the Mission since 1981. So, you know, I've watched all the changes. I have my business. I work at 24th and Mission at Dance Mission. And so I, you know, kind of have a bird's eye view on what's happening. So we're all really engaged in all of that. And we've made an artistic response to what's happening, and also what's just happening generally in, you know, international world kind of politics at the same time.
Yeah. So you have an all-female cast, and you use explosive text, drumming, dance, and theater to examine the dismantling of the Mission District through forced displacement. And it's set in a junkyard on the outskirts of town, a junkyard full of car parts, boats, bathtubs, and found and discarded objects. 10 exiled women dance and drum their way through their nightmares and dreams about the effects of local and global politics. So how do you do that?
Well, you work on it for a long time. That we've been in, you know, a massive amount of rehearsals since September, and we actually started working on the drumming, you know, in July. So I kind of drove most of the script, and, you know, I'm a self-described news junkie, so I'm watching and listening and examining and reinterpreting the news all the time. And I've actually been at this kind of dance theater, you know, my whole adult life, so I have a lot of resources to draw upon. So that's just kind of the background of, you know, how you make all this. A lot of the women that are in the show, I've been dancing and working with since the early 90s. So we have a very multi-generational cast of women. We have, you know, some women in their early 20s, some women in their 30s, and we have some women in their 50s and 60s who have put this whole thing together. So it really, you know, and it's very multicultural, and it's really, you know, a wide scope of women and different kinds of women, and, you know, finding our voice around, you know, what's actually happening in the world right now. You know, there's a lot of anxiety and fear around what's going on with the environment. We're in, you know, just a massive upheaval on the environment, you know, with still not a consensus from, you know, the powers that be. Or if they do have a consensus, they don't tell us they have a consensus. And, you know, there's that, and there's, you know, the hemorrhaging of money and the economy and the kind of the rebooting of our economy through, you know, infusing, you know, all this money into, you know, printing dollars and not really building a real economy. It's the economy that's happening here in San Francisco of Silicon Valley that's moved into the Mission, and now we're a bedroom community for the corporations down south. And so it's all of these things together are creating a level of tension and anxiety in people, and you really feel it here in the Mission, you know, with the shutting down of the Google buses and all the many immigrant families getting displaced, and all of that's kind of on top of each other, and we kind of try to dig through that and make sense of that and what's, you know, what's really happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and in all of your work, you know, the personal, you know, is politic, the personal, and particularly the personal, the body, embodiment of the politic. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, the people, the analysis, you know, of some of the characters that you depict. You mentioned, well, in the press release, it's mentioned, you know, that you look at the stories of recently evicted Mission residents, Rebecca and Guillermo. Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk about how they show up, and also sort of, you know, that creative process. You know, you bring in music, and of course the lyrics are part of the conversation as well. So, I wonder if you could talk about sort of these characters that show up, so we can be looking for them.
Yes, well, the character, there's, you know, the women have different characters, and a lot of it, it's not a play, so their characters kind of emerge and move out as they kind of relate a lot collectively. It's kind of a collective voice, but, you know, there's the one of the characters is a woman who was, you know, displaced by Katrina, moved to San Francisco to live with her aunt, and then she gets evicted and Ellis Dacked out and ends up homeless. There's another one that was a vet. We know that most of the homeless are vets. There's one woman in the show who, you know, is a conspiracy theorist, sort of like, you know, lots of us are, and she's afraid Nibiru is going to hit, the big comet's going to hit, so she packed everything up and moved to the country. I mean, there's an artist that was evicted. So those are just, you know, some of the kind of background stories on some of the women. We bring in Rachel Corey, who was young woman who was defending that village in Palestine that was crushed by the Caterpillar bulldozers, and how there was a boycott on Caterpillar, but now if you look around the Mission, there's nothing but Caterpillar bulldozers around. So what's the connection there? You know what I mean? So, you know, so we bring that in. We talk a lot about global warming. My character is kind of a weather witch. Is always trying to figure out which way the wind is blowing, and can't figure anything out anymore because the wind's blowing, you know, from many different directions right now. So it's really hard to track the weather. And what's the implications of that? And then there's an underlying theme of the whistleblower, the Cassandra, the woman who's the Vola Spa that sees the future, and, you know, what happens to whistleblowers, how they're, you know, exiled, and the whole you know, NSA connection and the whole, you know, and what is Google's relationship to the NSA and what is Facebook and what's the internet to all of us and who is this, what is this thing that's just moved in that's actually cooperating with the NSA? So all of those different ideas are woven together and we talk about them, we yell about them, we dance about them, we drum, we're all good taiko drummers, there's some amazing drumming in the show. You know, so it's, you know, there's this feeling of camaraderie. We're living in this junkyard. We've been kicked out, kicked to the curb, and we're going to, you know, take a stand about it. And there's two of the women sing really well, and we, you know, weave in Pink Floyd's Welcome to the Machine. So it's a wild ride, but it's only an hour and 15 minutes. And you sort of, you know, you get on the magic carpet with us, and you just kind of soar through this, you know, proclamation. We make a lot of accusations. We have a lot of, you know, heartbreaking feelings, and, you know, we call people out. It's real. It's really about what's going on. We don't mince any words, and, you know, we encourage people who are concerned, deeply concerned, come and get reinforced to look at the world and tell the truth about what's going on.
Wow. I was just thinking about, you know, the whole name of your company, Dance Brigade, and then we've got Dance Mission, which is almost and you know, it's an imperative, dance mission.
Yes.
You know, like
yeah,
you know, our mission is to move. I wonder if you could talk about sort of the whole idea of Dance Brigade, which is, you know, you think about a brigade and they are you know, they're sort of like the front line, and they're the soldiers, they're the watchers, they're the ones that keep us safe. And you think
and
about a dance brigade at you know.
Well, you know, that name, you know, I was in the mother company of Dance Brigade was the Wallflower Order, and we had a split. We broke up in the 80s, and it was a contentious split. And we called ourselves Dance Brigade out of that because we were all really involved in the solidarity movement. And all these brigades were going to Cuba and going to El Salvador and going to Nicaragua. So we realigned ourselves with our political roots by naming our company Dance Brigade. And actually, we've influenced, I think, a lot of other organization dance groups to call themselves Brigade. There's quite a few dance-related. There's the Carpetbag Brigade that does stilt walking. So it's a name that really caught. And we, you know, want to, you know, we identify with being part of a social movement. So that's where the name Brigade came into our work particularly.
Yeah, it's sort of like when you think about the whole term of comrade, when you talk about the people that are working with you, you know, you're aligned politically and culturally and socially. Yeah, it's sort of like the brigade seems like a similar kind of use.
Yeah. I mean, we came out of, you know, I came out because I'm older than most of the people in the group, but I came out of that whole idea of being cultural workers, you know, as artists. We, you know, this is the early 70s when we were forming all of these ways of working as artists, and a big part of what we were doing was being self-described cultural workers, which I think actually came out of either Ho Chi Minh or Mao or something like that. And so we identified with being part of people, you know, we talked a lot about the artist not being elitist and, you know, being of and from and part of a community that created work that reflected the real concerns of what was going on with people. So that's been the roots of the organization since, you know, the early 70s, and, you know, it's very much reflected in all our programs at Dance Mission, where we have a really strong African arts program, and we have, you know, 100 girls in our Girl Brigade program. We're teaching the next generation of young women to be social activists and political artists. And we have a big children's school where they learned all the different kinds of dance and drumming that we do. And, you know, we have a theater and we make it available. It's very low income, but it's got really good equipment. So we have a community theater with professional lighting and all of those kinds of things that make the art look better, and, you know, we make it available. We're trying to, you know, there's a genuine trying to make a difference in the world. That's our mission.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, and And, you know, this past season you brought back the revolutionary Nutcracker Sweetie, which is, you know, is so
yes.
wonderful. And yeah, we're so happy to see that back. It's like, wow, you know, once you've gone revolutionary, you can't go back.
Well, that's true. You know, the revolutionary Nutcracker Sweetie was the piece that we did from 1996 to 2007, and it was about, you know, it was over in Oakland at the Scottish Rite Temple, you know, and it was a huge community extravaganza. There were, you know, 1,300 people came over, you know, every show for the over the weekend. And now we've scaled it back, and we do it at the Brava Theater Center, and we do it with our youth program. And all our young women, the girls that have been training with us, play all the solo parts. This year was the first time we did that. So that's just a remarkable achievement on their part and on our part that we've kept this tradition of the Nutcracker going, and we've also, again, brought it into the next generation of dancers. And so, you know, it's a lot of work, and we're really, you know, happy with the results.
Right. Yeah, I want to let our audience know we're speaking to Chrissy Kiefer, director of and founder of, artistic director, founder of the Dance Brigade, and and also you are artistic director, or let's see, for Dance Mission. Yeah, you're artistic director also of Dance Mission Theater.
Yes.
Yeah, and want to let people know how they can come see the show that starts tonight. So Hemorrhage, an Abolition of Hope and Despair, a dance installation at the intersection of the new San Francisco and world politics, is tonight, January 24th through February 8th, Thursday through Saturday at 8 p.m., Sunday at 6 p.m., and the Saturday, February 8th shows are at 4 and 7 at Dance Mission Theater, 3316 24th Street, right across the street from the BART station. And tickets are $15 to $30, and you can get them on brown paper tickets or 1-800-838-3006. And you can also visit dancemission.com, and the phone number there is 415-826-4441. Anything else you want to tell us about the logistics and stuff like that? I know people need to be on time.
Actually, because we've redone the theater, you know, we've literally loaded in a junkyard onto the bleachers, and we've reconfigured the seating for those of you who come to see shows at Dance Mission. There is no late seating because it will be impossible to seat people if once the show started. So, and there's hard parking at Dance Mission. So we just encourage anybody who's coming out to, you know, leave early, take BART. We're right across the street from the BART station. Come on in. We encourage people to get the tickets in advance. We've already sold almost half of them. So we would really like, and we really want people to see it. We want your feedback, and, you know, we want, you know, the community to come out and get reinforced to, you know, face and confront what's going on in San Francisco and how we can work together to keep our city the shining example of, you know, a city that cares. You know, we care deeply about what's going on in the world, and we need to keep caring together. So just those are the only little things I want to add.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and I have one more question and a comment. I was wondering, the director of, a director, but the founder of the Dia de los Muertos exhibit at SOMARTS, he was evicted
Renee.
From his home. Renee. And I was wondering, sort of, do you have any, do you know what's happening around that? Like, did he end up being able to stay at his place, or is he still having to move?
No, he moved. I think he moved.
Oh,
yeah.
Did?
And
oh,
that,
he did. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's a high-profile, you know, comrade of our, you know, San Francisco cultural mecca, and that was very distressing, and, you know, maybe a little good thing is it started really opening people's eyes to what was going on. But I live at 21st and Cap. I'm watching people fleeing from the mission because they can't afford it, because their landlords are harassing them, because there's pressure from the new people that have moved into the building. They don't like the lifestyle of the old hippie guard. And so it's edgy and it's tense, and it's deep. It's really unfortunate. And, you know, Renee is one of many, and I think that he found a place, and I you know, that, you know, quote, works for him. You know,
right.
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard when you've lived somewhere for 25 years to have to move, and people are being uprooted all over this city.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the last question has to do with your productions are, I mean, they actually sort of change the landscape. I mean, they're so memorable, the people that are able to attend and participate and be in the space. Once you've done, you know, a Dance Brigade production, you're not the same anymore. Like, when you walk out, you see everything looks different.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And so I was just wondering, yeah. I mean, everything, it's just so memorable. Thinking about, you know, when the Mayan calendar shifted, I mean, you know, that experience. And then the one when we had a 1 billion rising, you know, last February.
Yeah.
That was awesome. And so I was wondering, sort of for you, you know, as you know, you and the other women, you know, create these conversations, you bring us into these conversations, which are swirling all around. It's not like, you know, this stuff is new. It's sort of like a Michael Moore film. I mean, it was all there in the public domain. You just pull it together for us really well, you know, like he does in his films. And so I was wondering, for you, this particular piece, you know, Hemorrhage, how is it different than, let's say, you know, some of the other work you've done, and why is this so important, like right now, that we pay attention? Because hemorrhage, you know, you could bleed to death. Hemorrhaging doesn't mean that there's a tourniquet that you've stopped the bleeding. So it's open.
Right.
I mean, we're still bleeding when, you know, we finish the show, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting, first of all, thank you for what you said about the work that we do. That I almost started to cry because, you know, sometimes you get involved in all this and you think, why am I working so hard? You know what I mean? It's like, oh my God, I don't need to do another show, you know? And then, you know, somebody says what you just said and it's like it all sort of becomes worth it because it actually, you people are seeing, we're all seeing something together, which is, you know, the moment in the theater when we all kind of get in a collective swirl about what's happening. And, you know, that's always kind of my goal in my work, is that at one moment in the, you know, everybody's on the same page. You know, I'm not the kind of artist that wants everybody to go away with lots of different, you know, fragmented ideas about what happened. So thank you. I just want to say thank you. And, you know, I think the title's hard for people. The hemorrhaging is, you know, the hemorrhaging of, you know, oil, the hemorrhaging of the blood in the Middle East, the hemorrhaging that's going on in different places in Africa with the situation of women and the violence, the hemorrhaging of our economy, the hemorrhaging of people being kicked out, the hemorrhaging of the polar ice caps. Like, you know, it's serious. It's so serious what's going on. And I don't have an answer. I never have really an answer because I've been kind of a, you know, not very confident that we are actually going to work our way out of this, but I am confident that we can show up, look at it, acknowledge it, and, you know, try to provide resistance against complacency. And so that's the goal. That's my personal goal in my life for myself, and I hope it's infectious, and I try to do it by entertaining people and moving people and, you know, bringing people together and celebrating our humanity.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Chrissy, for continuing to help us, you know, stay human. You do bleed.
Yeah.
We all do. That's something we have in common, one of the things we have in common. And perhaps, you know, at this particular production, you know, this conversation that you are inviting us to participate in, we'll at least be able to sort of pull out the first aid kit and throw in some things, some tools, you know, just by having the conversation.
Funny, you will see a first aid kit. You know, and the other thing about what, you know, there is one, and then the other thing is that You know, hemorrhage is very specific to women and women's, you know, blood, women and women's rights right now, which, you know, you cannot believe from the 70s to now some of the steps that have been taken to keep us from having reproductive rights. I mean, it's unbelievable, really. So, and we are all women, and we are trying to talk about the world, particularly from a strong, conscious women's point of view, and I think we achieved that by the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I was just thinking also, you know, so blood is the creative force. You
yes.
know, it's that element.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you got to
yes.
have the blood.
Yes.
Yeah. And cause, and everything is in the blood.
Yes, absolutely.
All of the answers, you know, all of the puzzles, you know, the creative
yeah.
DNA is all there. Yeah, what a great title.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. I hope I'm going to see you there at some point, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're going to come.
I'll opening night. I'll be
there. Oh, good. Yay. Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Well, say hello when it's over, okay?
Oh, I certainly will. And
okay.
And your good friend Louisa Teach is going to be joining me in a few minutes, so I'll tell her that you were on right before.
And tell her to come to our show, okay?
Oh, I
Hi, Louisa.
Will.
I know you're there somewhere. Okay.
All right, you take good care. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
bye.
You take care. Bye-bye. So we were speaking to Chrissy Kiefer, Dance Mission, about their latest production, Hemorrhage, and you definitely don't want to miss it. It's up through tonight, the 24th through February 8th, and they have multiple productions. So you want to get your tickets because it's a small venue, but it's always the work, it's, oh my goodness, it's life shifting, it's DNA shifting, it's really awakens one's consciousness. She is such a creative artist and wonderful treasure that we have in the Bay Area, so I'm really happy that she is doing the work. Alrighty, so we are waiting for Javelin Richards and Louisa Teach to join us to talk about Miss Pat's house and the Voodoo Queen, who is going to be visiting. So while we wait for that to happen, I am going to play something from, I'm looking at Shinakari Julia Titsi Shigamba, and I'm looking at Mabakumba. So I think I'm just going to go just play that because I'm looking at it and it's like calling me. So here we are. Oh, let's see. Hello. Is this Javelin?
Yes, it's Javelin.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
hey, how are you?
Good.
I forgot I put myself on mute because I was going to call you to see if you had gotten the invitation. And, said she was going to join us. Have you talked to her?
No, I talked to her briefly yesterday, but not – yes, she did say she was going to be on the radio this morning.
Yeah. Do we want to put a song on and you call her, or just to
see? Yeah, put a song on. I'll dial her on my cell phone because I'm on the landline.
Okay. All right, cool. Let me put Julia back on. Okay.
Okay.
Oh, there
okay.
she is. You don't have to.
Okay, perfect.
Voodoo woman, you must have heard us calling your name. How you doing? Yeah.
I'm good, baby. How you doing?
Oh,
can
I'm
you hear
fine.
Me?
Yeah, hey, you're great. It was just funny. Javelin and I were just calling your name, and you come on in just on cue.
Well, you know how spirit works. I tell people all the time the Internet, which we all love so much, is just an externalization of the Internet, I-N-N-E-R. We've been sending each other signals since the beginning of time. Now we do it with a machine.
I'm glad you said that. Good morning. This is Javelin. I'm glad you said that because a lot of people are trying to figure out technology and how it can be understood through our spiritual senses, and that in the way you just said it, put away that people can language it and start to embrace it. Someone else said the other day, it's another way to think about a writing tool. We used to have pens and paper, although there's no substitute for some people, but just being able to communicate is another way to look at it in the 21st century.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, there's two sides to this, you know. I am very, very grateful that I can sit in my room and send an email to a friend of mine in Europe and have it happen, you know, lickety-split, just like that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the shining light side of that is that it gives us the opportunity to network globally. The shadow side of that is that I think in some respects it is also warping people's brains because we now have nanosecond impatience. If something doesn't happen in 3 minutes, then we're upset about it. You cannot, unless you tune in like we did just now, you can't get the emotional energy of what's going on with people through the technology. So, unfortunately, we have a phenomena called catfishing, where people are creating false images of themselves, courting people, causing folks to fall in love with them, and they turn out to not be who they are at all. So, you know, the only remedy for the situation is to use the technology with your spiritual faculty in place. Otherwise, you have the situation. There's a lot of women who have fallen in love with a phantom in cyberspace.
Mm-hmm.
A phantom in cyberspace, and that's a very dangerous thing. But again, on the other hand, you know, it is possible for young girls in South Africa who would ordinarily be completely cut off from the world to go onto the Internet and be connected to sisters and brothers all over the world. So like everything, it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's tell our audience about In the House of the Mothers, an interactive visit with Miss Pat Javelin's Richard's character, and the Voodoo Queen, Louisa Tisha's character. And it's going to happen, this is one evening only, at the Pena Culture Center in Berkeley on January 26th, this Saturday at 7 p.m. Saturday? Oh, sorry, I meant Sunday. I said 26 and I said the wrong day. Hope you all caught that. January 26th at 7 p.m. And Miss Pat's house is occupied by amazing characters with stories of trials and triumphs. The voodoo priestess comes to visit Miss Pat with a bundle of herbs and a pocket full of charms. And the audience is invited to interact with these wise women through story sharing, ritual, movement, and song. So it's going to be live music, jazz, and blues. So it's going to be really wonderful. So this particular character, Miss Pat, is one that a lot of people are probably familiar with because she has a house and she has a lot of folks that live there. The new guest, the Voodoo Queen, she's a new to this particular environment, so it's going to be really wonderful. So I wonder if you both could take turns talking about what's going to happen with regards to this visit at Miss Pat's house by the Voodoo Queen and the whole idea of ritual theater, which is this is the first of many such visits, interactive visits at Miss Pat's house by the Voodoo Queen.
Sort of a backdrop of Miss
Pat. Open up since I'm a guest at her house.
Right, right. Okay, yes, I'll give a backdrop. For folks, some people know Miss Pat's house because she's been performing at the La Pena Culture Center for the last, this will be the fourth year. So every August she usually appears. Miss Pat's house is a home that was in the 1930s during the Great Depression, and it was labeled a brothel. Miss Pat's house, really what this is a space for people who had came to tell their stories and to heal, and they had no other place to go domestically or globally. So the characters come from all over the world to be in Mrs. Pat's house, and they arrive there mysteriously to themselves and to her. And they come there in the shadows of some magical sense of existence, essence, right when they're most challenged in a moment. So an example would be a character who came to Miss Pat's house 3 years ago named Miss Lily. Miss Lily came there. She had been living in a small town outside of Paris, and she was passing for white. She was originally born in Alabama, but she left Alabama. She was born to a brown woman with mystical powers, alligators, swamp land, and her mother gave her everything that she thought she needed to be in the world, education, exposure. All the time, this woman did her work in the backwoods of Alabama, sent her daughter out to the best of the best because she had a lot of connections with people of influence. So Miss Lily grows up and she leaves her mama, doesn't tell her where she's going, leaves home, moves to Paris, learns a new language, begins to teach, and passes as a white woman. Lo and behold, a white man, very affluent family, is visiting Paris on business, and he spots Miss Lily with some children, and there's something about her that makes her familiar and very different than the women in his social clubs, society. He begins to court Miss Lily and asks Miss Lily to marry him. She comes back to America, but he never knows that this is her place of origin. And she has a personal maid who is a black woman who looks a lot like her mama. She's still passing. Miss Lily then gives birth. On the day that she gives birth, the child is born dark. And the moment that he walks in the room at her birth with his cigar, at that time you could smoke in the room while he was having a baby, a man was not in the room. He comes in, he sees this dark baby, and he has one fundamental question. Did he have sex with a nigger, or did his wife have sex with the nigger? At that moment, something in the universe, because in his mind, that question leads him to want to destroy both her and this dark child. In that moment, something in the universe opens, and Miss Lily escapes and finds herself with breast milk dripping down her gown, childless, at the door of Miss Pat's. So this would be one of the ways in which the characters get there. This is one example. And then this year, being with Tish and talking with her, just about stuff in general, and she recognized something that I do, and that's develop characters, and I recognize that she hands me characters, she becomes a character. Right. And so we're in the midst of two different characters, so we're going back and forth and having a good time with it, and we decided to work together. And in this work, Tisha's coming to the house to bring, she's actually put deeper clarity for me as a writer and a performer, deeper clarity, because this is the work she does in the world, a clarity to really, to deepen the definition of what is really going on So the mystical force, what's really going on, she traced it back through our history. And now she's coming to Miss Pat's, bringing Desiree to come there to do a different kind of ritual. So it just deepens the story. And so then I'll let Tish take over what's going to happen on her end, or where she comes from her perspective of this work.
Well, I tell y'all, I'm at my house in New Orleans minding my own self-business when the spirits start knocking on my head and telling me that I got to take a journey to this woman's house. Now, I don't know Miss Pat from nobody, but all I know is the spirits at my altar won't let me rest.
Mm-hmm.
When I tell them that I don't know this woman and I don't know how to get there, they tell me to let myself be guided by the wand of my woo. Now, the wand of my woo is an ancient thing that that we as a people had in pre-colonial times. It is a staff made of sacred wood that has been properly dressed and is inhabited by the spirit of a tracker, of a messenger, of a leader. And so the wand of my woo is guiding me through different physical spaces that represent different historical events. So we imagine that we know that the wand of my woo used to lead messengers through the bush from Ile Ife to Benin, carrying messages between dignitaries. We imagine that a wand of my woo made its way across the water and helped people to follow the drinking gourd north. You know, I believe it was both Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman had a staff that they
mm-hmm.
carried, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the spirit of the wand of my woo leads you to the place where spirit wants you to go, whether you want to go there or not.
Mm-hmm.
So all that I know when I'm on my journey is that spirit has told me to go to this woman's house, but spirit has also supplied me with everything that I need so that once I get there, I am able to cleanse the energy of all of these different things that this woman has experienced. Now,
mm-hmm.
what I didn't say just now is that I get the audience involved from the very beginning. Because this is ritual theater, it has to be done in ritual context, okay? The big difference between regular theater and ritual theater is that oftentimes in regular theater, there's a fourth wall where the performers are separate from the audience. In ritual theater, that is quite the opposite is true, and the audience is really a village of people who contribute to the energetic progression of the piece. So
mm-hmm.
it's going to open with an invocation to specific ancestors of this work, and the audience is invited to participate in that honoring from the beginning. There's another piece in there where the audience gets to help divine the future
mm-hmm.
of the woman,
mm-hmm.
of the energy that's being healed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another possibility closer to the end where somebody in the audience will get a personal charm from Desiree, who is a devotee of Marie Laveau. So it promises to be interactive. It's definitely interactive.
Mm-hmm. And with in this particular story, the voodoo woman is called to the house because the character, as I said earlier, is called at a moment of crisis. So the character arrives at all the folks who come to Miss Pat's house. And sometimes I say Miss Pat, Mrs. Pat, because they're different years she's open. She was either married or unmarried. So when I say that, let that clear up your confusion. Mm-hmm. She is sometimes married. She is sometimes not, because that's Miss Pat. And so in this particular story, the crisis that has occurred in 1933 is that there's been a murder. And as in the investigation, Negro at that time, the language has escaped. There's a doctor that's been murdered, a black woman, a Negro who has been accused of the murder, and doing questioning, she escapes. She finds herself at Miss Pat's house. And we discover that this woman has something that belongs to the spiritual world that ails her, that challenges her, which is why she was at the doctor's office. She was asking him to help her, to take this and fix it for her, because it was deeply troubling and it was manifesting itself physically, but it was coming to her through dreams, and he could not help her. And something happened, and there was a killing. We don't know how that happens, really. And she finds herself in police questioning. And again, this is 1933. There's a Negro woman about to be handcuffed. You do the backdrop on that story in your own head.
Mm-hmm.
And she finds herself standing at the back door of Miss Pat's house. That is her miracle for the night. But that has not relieved what has happened. Ms. Pat, upon opening the door, seeing that this woman, different than the newspaper, because in the newspaper they had flat ironed her features. They had made her more ape-like than the human.
Mm.
But in front of her is a woman whose skin is the color of late autumn. Her features are soft and undisturbed by hard work. And she is looking at Miss Pat, wondering, where am I at now? When Miss Pat says, come in the house, she realizes that this woman is not alone. And so there she calls upon the only other person in the house who could possibly help her understand what's going on. And that's a 103-year-old woman who comes every year. If you've ever been to Miss Pat's house, you will have met Miss Lucy. She's played vaudeville. She was born into slavery, and it is her who actually calls on Desiree from the bayous and minding her own business, as Teach say, Miss Lucy, 103. Who has gone through slavery, seen emancipation, and walked into freedom, did vaudeville, which was a whole nother talk show, as she says, or I say in present time. And she lets Miss Pat know, and this woman, this is bigger than anything I can do. And she calls out. And the audience, what I love about this piece is that I don't know at the very end, the character doesn't know at the very end, that the audience actually will hold the key, one of the keys, to where what direction this woman will take. And that's another level of their participation. They will hold, as Teach was saying, her future in literally in their hands.
Yep.
So it's no different when I was sharing that with someone. They was like, well, what do you mean by that? And what's going on? And there's going to be ghosts up in there, and I got to... and what Teach going to do to me? And I... I'm scared. And these are the, wait, this is the folks that's inside the performance.
Well, you know, I may have to take a teaching moment and explain the difference between supportive ancestral spirits and
ghosts. What I've been sharing with folks is that I love the fact that they are nervous, because what the nervousness says to me that we believe. we believe, that we know that we are connected to something powerful and wonderful, but filtered through patriarchal systems, we believe it. We're comfortable if it walks on water.
Mm-hmm.
We're comfortable if it's at a Sunday ritual where a man called a priest is dressed up in a gown and shaking smoke at us and telling us to eat the body of Christ. We're okay with that. And I'm talking about my own experience being raised Catholic. We're comfortable believing in something other than us if we're sitting in a restaurant and they give us our fortune cookies, and everybody takes a moment to break it open and read it out loud and go, oh, yeah, I was hoping this here. If it says, you will find the love of your life. Wow!
Mm-hmm.
So that we're wired in present time to be okay with that. And so what I love about this introduction in my work of ritual theater is it only redefines what we already know to be true. It only allows us the gift to be able to hold on to what our ancestors knew. When they knelt down, let's just, for example, in fields and under slavery, and when they offered prayer to the earth and said, please, God, let me get through this here. Please, God, I imagine a pregnant woman, God, let my child have no better than I know. Let my child know better than I know. And if that prayer is the one in which we are in dialogue now because of that prayer, then that's what ritual theater opens up to us, the possibilities. And everybody knows that in times when we're challenged to say, oh, God, please help me, or even as much as driving this morning on our way to somewhere and running late, say, oh, God, oh, I got to get here. Please let me get here. Ooh, let traffic be okay. We do it all the time. We do ritual all the time. We pray all the time. So that's what I've been sharing with folks. And this is an opportunity just to have some good time at a theater, to come to Miss Pat's. And I've learned so much more about the characters in a way. And this is about healing. How does this woman who is being accused of murder and murdered Dr. C. Owens, an upstanding black doctor, what happens with her? What happened in that office? And what will this healing do for her?
Yeah. Let me interrupt you there for a second. I want to let our audience know that we're speaking to Javelin Richards and Yaya Louisa Tisch about In the House of the Mothers, an interactive visit with Miss Pat and the Voodoo Queen, written and performed by Javelin Richards and Louisa Tisch on Sunday, January 26th. 2014, 7 p.m., one night only at La Pena Cultural Center. What's the address for La Pena? 3105 Shattuck Avenue?
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. 3105 Shattuck Avenue.
And I think
Shattuck
the tickets
Avenue.
Are like $15. You should bring
$15.
Your folks.
$15. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I wanted to, I had a couple of questions. I've been like taking notes. But first I want to do a little bio. I want to let folks know that Louisa Tisch is a writer, performer, ritual artist, providing services for mind, spirit, and community. And she also is co-author of a recent book on Holy Ground, Commitment and Devotion to Sacred Lands with Leilani Byerly. And I noticed on your website, that you're going to be leading a trip to Bali this year.
Yes.
Yeah, March 28th to April 5th. That sounds fun.
Bali,
and that's an opportunity.
So if you can make it, people, you definitely sign up, because Bali is, there's no way, if you haven't been there, all I can say is paradise times five. Paradise. The land is exquisite. The people are beautiful. The food will make you crazy. The artwork is stunning. And these people do ritual every day. Every day starts out with elaborate ritual that is just so beautiful. It's hard to describe.
Mm.
Yeah. And Ms. Richards has an MFA. She's a published writer and solo performance artist. She resides in Oakland, California presently, and she's creator of the Nappy-Headed Love Stories, a series of theater performances examining black love and intimacy told through the voice of women and children. She's radio host of Cover to Cover, open book on KPFA 94.1 FM. And she's just all-around phenomenal woman. And this opportunity to see Javelin and Yaye Tish in the theater together is going to just be simply phenomenal. And I wondered, if you could, you mentioned that you were going to give a little teaching moment about the difference between ghosts and supportive ancestral spirits. I wonder if you could maybe give us the short version of that now so that people will come.
Right. Yeah. See, here's the difference. The difference is called popular television. Popular television is always going to give you what I call the ooh-wee spooky spookies that is all about the ghost who's not at rest, who's tracking murder, who is going to suck the blood out of your neck. You know, that unfortunately is what people love, what people have learned to be afraid of and at the same time attracted to. I'm not talking about that, okay? That's a real realm of people who are caught in between dimensions. What I'm talking about is the ancestors who have sustained us generation after generation after generation. Their surviving intelligence, their surviving energy, coming to heal, coming to perform the kind of work that we've done forever, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that needs to be said, and maybe this will make it really, really clear for people, popular culture has you afraid of the mummy who's running around killing people. The truth of the matter is the mummy is put in its tomb and grave robbers go and disturb the mummy. Popular culture has you afraid of the zombie who's running around beating up people. The truth of the matter is real zombies are passive slaves working on a plantation somewhere, okay? Popular culture has you believing that any psychic power that you have is automatically going to go to corruption when the truth of it is that American advertising exploits the same clair features, the same spiritual energy that you are entitled to. So the person who's driving along the freeway and they see four or five billboards that tells you things go better with coke are going to be hypnotized into going and drinking some coke, even though it's going to eat out the lining of their stomachs. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always inviting people to take a deeper look at what's going on because your natural spiritual power has been corrupted since the Inquisition by the Catholic Church many, many centuries ago. So, you know, I think if anybody's afraid of a ghost, they should come and confront one.
And they should come because they nosy. And they love jazz and blues. I would come just because I'm nosy. Because it's going to be so much fun and so much love and so much laughter. And that's the good part of it, and that just theater, and as you said, now breaking the fourth wall. I'm a storyteller, so that wall has always been open. As born a storyteller, I think that my ancestors probably traveled through different parts and would walk into rooms, tribes, fields of people and began to tell the stories based on the energy of the people that they met and based on what they knew to be true from where they had come. And so I think just the fun of it and the love of it and just the curiosity, I think that, Wanda, you probably have a lot of curious folks about first of all, very smart folks. only, and when I say smart, I don't mean just IQ, emotionally intelligence, and spiritual connection. So you have those folks who are their awareness. So I say come because you're nosy, too, because you want to be teaching Joplin, because they want to be teaching Joplin, working on the stage, having fun and playing. They want to see Miss Lucy if they know Miss Lucy, too, and see what she's doing this year. So it's going to be a really we put this together in the last 3 weeks, actually. And so that's been a wonderful journey, and we're just going to have a good time with it. And the goal, one of the goals is that we want to present this work every month at La Pena to look at using ritual theater to look at some of the present time challenges we are faced, whatever they may be, and you know, whatever they may be. When I say that is, it could be housing issues. So to take what seems heavy, put it inside of the characters' lives to make it personal. So when I say heavy, that means something outside of us that we say, oh, my gosh, the world is falling apart, the sky is falling, and make it less heavy in that is digestible in somebody with hands, feet, eyes, lips, so that we can hold them. Put that challenge in a character. Put them in Ms. Pat's house, and then see what happens emotionally and spiritually to the person, to give ourselves strength, to give ourselves a place to care for one another, care for the planet, care for, and to address political, social, personal. So that's the goal, is to eventually create performance work, ritual performance, to look at what you hear on the news or in our lives, economically, politically, and then to say, oh, let me go to Ms. Pat's house, and I hear they're dealing with this here this month. Let's see what's going down, a place to be warm and connected with other people, break our own isolations. And they have a restaurant now. La Pena has taken over the restaurant. When I say take over, not in a way we think about it, but it was leased out to other restaurant owners, and now they are now working with their own staff. They've taken that space as well to be a part of the performance space. So you can come there early, like this Sunday, at 5:30. It opens and have food, and then walk right across the hallway to the theater. You could also go online now to event. We'll go to La Pena's website and get tickets early if you want to. Well, early means 2 days early.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, I was just thinking as you were speaking, Joplin, about the whole idea of embodiment and how, you know, taking these issues and maybe even worries and externalizing them, like embodying them and then externalizing so people can see them at work and be able to work it out. And I was also thinking about how, you know, by taking, you know, a trouble or a trauma and embodying it could also be a way to bless it, you know, because you could put it in the character and then it could work it out and then it's gone, which is really wonderful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I thought, I was wondering, since you all have been rehearsing for the past, how many weeks, 3 weeks, that maybe you could maybe give us a little bit of what people can expect from the Voodoo Woman Visits Miss Pat's House.
Well, actually, I prefer to surprise you.
Yes.
I ain't giving away nothing.
Yeah,
I
because us,
that,
yes,
I
when I say rehearse, really,
knowing, get with some idea of what it is that they need for their life at this point and being prepared to receive advice from the Voodoo Queen.
Because although the story is taking place, it, in a way, one of the reasons why the music's been being rehearsed, that's the biggest part of it, the story itself, people who come there will have an opportunity to look at characters who are dealing, although it looks like heavy subject matters. This woman has been accused of murder, right?
Yeah.
But inside of there, there's this kernel of isolation that really, there's other things that belong to that. And if you just think about 1933, Cleveland, Ohio, during the Great Depression, Negroes, and things are happening all around you, just come up with your own grocery list by thinking about fast forward today. Political, social, economical challenges. And so those are sort of the when I, even as I say it, it sounds so rigid, this is really an emotional, spiritual place. So just come and bring whatever you have in your heart, whether you know it or not, just come and sit down, and there'll be some singing. There's a beautiful, I can share that. There's a beautiful song that I have in all of my work that I would love for some of the audience who feels like it. There's a moment in there that one of the characters needs so much for a lullaby. They need a lullaby, and so the vocalists will share that, and the audience can, if they want, join them in that very simple lullaby. It's like seeing someone in a fetal position in the streets, let's just say today, and they look at you and they say, I just want a lullaby. And someone starts singing, sleepy time, and then I see la, 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 la. And if they said it again, I need a lullaby, somebody might join and go, la, 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 and it'll help them get up. You'll do it. You would do it. So that's not the lullaby that's going to be sung. just an example. Yes, I just gave an example because I haven't had my coffee or my tea, and I'm like, oh, with a lullaby.
So, Javelin, who's going to be, I know you're going to be having, you have mm-hmm. artistic director Stephanie mm-hmm. Johnson is going to be she's mm-hmm. stage directing, but who are the musicians and artists that are going to be joining you all at Miss Pat's house?
Larry Otis is on guitar, and Kimberly Turner is a vocalist. Jesse Shoham is one of the vocalists, and then Colin Hamilton is on violin as well as piano. So Larry, Jesse, Kim, and Colin.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Colin is joining us for the first time. Kim has been with me since Come Home and at the Marsh. I did the Come Home. We ran for 5 weeks at the Marsh in San Francisco. Jesse mm-hmm. joined me a year ago with Larry. Mm-hmm. And Colin is coming aboard for the first time for this show.
Right. That's so nice. Yeah. It's gonna really be lovely. I'm gonna see, gosh, how I'm gonna mm-hmm. be in two places at once. It should be interesting. I want to let you know, Tease, that Chrissy Kiefert told you hi. They opened the Hemorrhage at the Dance Mission tonight, and mm-hmm. Thematically, you all are overlapping because, of course, Dance Brigade, you know, they're always talking about things that are current and topical, specifically, you know, mm-hmm. coming. Using a woman's body as the place where this gets worked out and worked through. And they're also, in one of the themes, because of the mission, is gentrification. And you talked about that a little bit, Javelin, yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so Chrissy says she wants to see you in the theater. So you have until February 8th to get over.
Oh, yeah, that's a done deal, because Chrissy don't know it yet, but I got a proposition for her. Ha-ha.
Uh-huh. Cool. Yeah, and I just thought about Miss Pat's house and the voodoo priestess's visit that, you know, you're starting a new tradition here. This is the first of many visits, and, you know, we need tradition. We need that formality, which is rich, what something ritual is. So it's going to really be awesome. Really be awesome.
Yes. Yes. Thank
yes,
you.
Indeed. Well, you
all
know,
right. Thank you,
yes. I was involved with La Peña as far back as 1976, and the mural that's been on the front of the building.
Yeah.
Back then, I was the artistic director for Common Arts Cultural Center, and we designed Ocean Newman, Ana de Leon, Ray Patlan, O'Brien Teal. You know, that was the committee of people who put together that Carlos Barón, that mural of Victor Jara on the front. And I used to stage things at La Peña all the time. So to a certain extent, it will be like a relative who left home and has come back to a remodeled house. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's interesting, that whole theme of home. There's a play being performed, stage reading at Joyce Gordon Gallery tomorrow as a part of the Lorraine Hansberry Theater's doing theater in the community, and it's called Home.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's at 2 o'clock tomorrow. It's a free performance. Like, wow, this is just so awesome. And then we have so much to be thankful for, and we have so many ancestors to honor. Just recently, you know, we've lost so many. So many have transitioned, you know, like Amiri Baraka and Mary Rudge.
Congratulations to Amiri Baraka.
Yeah, that was a beautiful homegoing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm so happy that, you know, we can look at Miss Pat's, resident, is it Miss Lucy, who's 100 and something? Is that her name?
She's 103, yes.
Yeah. That's so much to look forward to. Like, you know, you think you're 50, it's like, oh, man, life is over. Like, no, it's not. Miss Lucy's 103, and she's still kicking.
Right, she was 103 in when the show opened in 1933, so she was born in the 1800s, right. Mm-hmm.
Oh, so she's a lot older now. It's 2014. Wow.
She's a character. She can stay. She stays 103. Miss Lucy shows up, and she concerns less than a calendar on your wall. She will tell you this is her life. She is timeless.
Cool. Well, mm-hmm. At a certain point, time really is kind of irrelevant, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, the calendar, that is, that time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on this new collaborative work, and I'm so happy that I was present when it was born.
Yes.
And looking forward to participating in some way in that, and glad you all are, you know, talking about it here on the show. And, help me figure out how to do this.
What you want to do, baby?
I want to come. So you could, you know, send some inspiration to me so I can figure out how to do this and also do my work.
Oh, you're trying to buy locate?
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah, because this is my weekend to go to school, and I need to be there Sunday, and then I have to be at school on Monday. But I also have to do my work.
Oh, you can do it. You just said it. You said, help me to be there, so you want to be there. So that was the first thing, and so you're going to be there. You said, help me to be there. That means you want to be there. And the good news is the show's a little bit over an hour, so it's, 7 o'clock. You know, you said, wow, I'm going to be home by no later than 9? Oh, my gosh.
Well, I need to be in Southern California.
By what time?
I need to be there. I need to be there. I don't know how I can be there on. It doesn't. The time. Classes are Monday, but I have homework, so all that stuff needs to happen too. So that's why I need some help figuring this out.
Okay.
Well,
I've
been trying to figure out how to bilocate for about 30 years, and the only thing I've been able to do really is set up situations where I'm being seen on tape at the same hour in one place where I'm live somewhere else.
Okay.
If you figure out how to move the cells of your body, have Scotty beam you up and beam you back down, you let me know about it.
Okay, I sure will. In the meantime, Javelin, you said that you're going to be broadcasting live on KPFA or being taped by KPFA?
For this particular show, we're going to tape it, and then it'll probably play during February. But then the future, the proposal that I'm creating with Tish is that after this show, I want us, we do it every fourth Sunday. We create the show, we have a live audience, and then we tape it live through KPFA so that whatever the subject matter is, if it's gentrification, be it is happening to Mrs. Pat's house, the characters who are there, that it is a performance, it's a ritual performance, it's taped live, and that the host of the show that's hosting back at KPFA can talk about it from the political, whatever point of view they have, and then shoot back to the performers, and we hear that. And then afterwards, there's a talk back where the audience can have an opportunity to talk about their feelings around it. So you have several things happening at one time. So it's a new form of introduction of a performance that Tish and I are working on together. So that would be live performance with the host So talking about whatever it is that's being brought about, and they say now we get a chance to tune in to La Pena Culture Center, excerpts of the play, hear us on stage, hear the audience interact, and it becomes a different kind of 21st century way of being able to embrace the sometimes unmanageable in a theatrical way with ritual and healing, which is what performance was always about anyway on some level in my mind, the story in my mind, that people came to the theater to understand who are we as people, what do we do now that we are upright and moving, who are we? It's like anything, a raisin in the sun. It's just in terms of putting in this perspective in black work. It's anything that show does. When you turn on a TV, you're looking for information about who you are in relationship to. Well, Tisha and I are taking this here, and Stephanie Ann Johnson are taking this together and saying, what happens if you're listening to a radio show where the hosts are talking about it, breaking it down, decoding it from you from the way radio hosts do, and then there's a call-in show there, and then they're shooting it over to the live performance that's dealing with the same subject matter, and you have an opportunity to hear characters dealing with the same opportunity, subject matter. And then you have ritual theater where there's putting emotional healing, spiritual healing to in application to it, and then you have the audience as a part of it and a talk back of what people's individual feelings are about that. It's like, really? Is this happening? Where do I need to be at home listening to it? Do I need to run down to the show? Do I need to go to the theater? What's going on?
Yeah.
And that kind of vibration is what I'm interested in creating, something new that vibrates live, and it's like what jazz did. Like, what is that? What is that? And that's what I'm about in my work.
Yeah, because we could do that with at Wanda's Picks because we're internet, which means that all people have to do is have a phone, and they could be listening as they're doing whatever. So we could definitely be in the house. And definitely broadcast live on the air. And I hope that you all might be able to move this to Saturdays because then I won't have any problem with the bi-location.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So if we can't do the get you in two or three places, you and Tisha one time, I think we can push something to a Saturday. I know I can do that for you.
Let me
just check my calendar. Y'all know the kind of life that I live.
Yeah.
I just have to schedule way in advance. But I think that's very doable. If Saturday works better for people, because as I'm thinking about it, maybe a lot of people who have to go to work the next day. Let's look at Saturday.
Absolutely, but that's a new kind of theater that I'm interested in creating, where it has every element: radio, it has live, it's just so many different ways in which to hear the work, to play with the work, to be a part of the work, to be a part of the laughter, the healing, however you want to define it. But it's a new way to do it, and I am a visionary, and so I'm glad to be able to sit and be with other folks who also are visionaries and say, you know what, let's do this. It's like kids in some ways saying, can we go play what you want to play? Let's make it up. Well, we're making it up. We want every week for folks to be able to tune in. So you know every fourth, whether it's Saturday or Sunday, that KPFA have a live broadcast going down in La Pena, and it's a theater performance of this. And Wanda Picks, let me do a momentary timeout with myself. Okay, I'm back.
Well, you know, it looks like I'm looking right now at my at my calendar, and if we did Saturdays, February looks good. March looks really good because that would be the spring equinox when I have to do a ritual for the waters anyway.
Nice. Cool.
You know, we can really talk about this. This is looking pretty good. Of course, at a saner moment, I will, Joblin, I'll send you my Saturdays that are available.
Okay.
And we can get on this because, you know, this is tying in what we were talking about earlier, where technology
right
is married to real-time reality wrapped in a socio-spiritual understanding.
Right.
It makes multi, it's polyrhythmic. Is what I like about it.
Right. And then one of the beautiful things about it that Wanda was saying, that everybody has a phone, so when she's broadcasting it, Wanda picks. What I love about it is, I mean, I spent most of my career working in nonprofit, working in communities of color, brown and black communities that were challenged, and that theater just wasn't an option necessarily in the forefront of their consciousness. Like on a Saturday or Sunday, like theater was not it, and I totally got it.
Mm-hmm.
Which feels good, and at the same time, so I would bring theater to them in all the work I did, whether I was running a support group for a family or doing a home visit to deal with someone who had just walked out of a situation and whatever that was, and I would bring story into their home. So the thought in this moment that a family, a man who I just met a brother the other day, like in his 20s, who openly said, I've dealt with sexual trauma. I deal with the trauma of being viewed as a criminal every day. Every time I'm stopped, it recreates that early trauma. And I looked in his face, and I was like, oh, because it brought back so many. So I say that to say this, to think that someone with phones, that they can pick up the phone, dial in, listen to theater, listen to people discussing the subject matter at hand. Like one of my characters over the past that has come to Mrs. Pat's house he's a man living in the South. Again, it's always doing, my story starts from the Civil War up until World War II, and around, usually centered in the Great Depression, which is really similar to what we're dealing with now in North America. And he was living in 1930-something, dealing with his sexual identity, had finally found love, he thought, with another man. And in the homophobic act of them drinking, one of the men stabbed him, the man who he loved the most, but was doing it that et tu Brutus kind of a thing, like, you're betraying me because you have to, because there's this group of men egging you on to prove you're not gay. So what they say is then you stab him. So now, in that moment, can you imagine hearing that, hearing some of the challenges that move beyond time and communities that would not be in the theater would be able to tune in? Somebody says, tune in because Tisha Javelin is doing this particular piece on homelessness. The character has been thrown homeless. She has two kids, and it's 1937. It's in Cleveland, Ohio, and she's at Ms. Pat's house. Ms. Pat's like, "What? Why are you here?" And then there's a healing. That, to me, the thought of people being able to hear with their phone for an hour, theater, radio hosts talking about it from the political, social standpoint, the ritual of healing taking place for 1 hour, it just breaks open a new way of life for me, a new way of doing the work that I've always been committed to do in different communities throughout the United States. That's just that's my personal part of my personal drive, because I promised families when one of our budgets were cut and we couldn't, I had to leave, and they said, "Ms. Javelin, please don't go." And I said, "You know, I will never stop doing this work. I will always find ways to do it differently, but I will never stop doing this work, and I will find stages to do it so that the challenges that people without a voice that are dealing with without a voice, that they can be heard. And I will do that. As a writer, as a storyteller, I will find a way to do that. That I promise you. They can cut the funding. I cannot be here maybe next week this way, but I will find a way. And so this way, in discussions with Tish, with Stephanie, with you, Wanda, being able to create a new way to embrace, a new way to hear, to me, it's like, okay, let's do it. Let's
yes.
do it.
Yes, yes,
yes. Let's
do it. Go ahead, baby.
Yeah. Alrighty. So thank you both so much for joining us today on Wanda's Picks, and looking forward to seeing you in the theater and to having you on the air live. And we might even be able to facilitate that this Sunday. I've got to find somebody to do it for me.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Let us, yes, yes.
Yeah, I
and
can
then,
program
Tisha,
it.
And I'll see you this afternoon at 2 o'clock at La Pena. I'll swing by. We'll grab us maybe a bite and take it to La Pena and play in the theater for a while.
Okay, baby.
All right,
Wanda.
Hopefully I'll see you Sunday.
You're going to be playing in the theater at 2 o'clock today?
Yeah, I'm playing in the theater, too. I call it.
I think I can come through there and watch y'all play. Come maybe
by.
Join you.
Yes, we'll be
I
there
will certainly
2:00.
Be there.
Stephanie will be there. Let's go play. Can
oh,
y'all
I'll
come
by.
And play?
Oh, yeah,
okay.
I want to come play.
All right. All right, I'll see you there.
Okay. Yeah, do you need a lift or are you cool? Is Javelin picking you up?
Whoever closer.
Me up.
I'm going to get her. If you call to pick her up, she anywhere it goes, we all have a way to and from. We good.
Yeah, well, I think I'm closer. I could pick her up. You take her home.
Okay, got it.
Okay,
I'll
see you at 1:30.
1:30?
At 1:30,
okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
And maybe bring a bite, and we'll sit on the stage and have a bite and just sort of look at the space and talk about the space and then bring bread together and then start getting some work done.
Okay, cool.
All
so
right,
I'll
see y'all later.
After we finish. Okay, peace and blessings.
Okay, baby.
All
bye-bye.
Right, goodbye.
Bye. So we're going to play this song by Clara McDaniel, Pass Me Not, from the Amen Corner. And then I have another announcement about a musical event in Palo Alto. I think it's in Palo Alto.
Oh, you might as well get on your feet right now. Hallelujah, listen. This one says, pass me not, O gentle Savior. Hear my humble cry, while all others thou art calling God. Don't pass me by. Come on, it's an old school classic. Keep turning around. Try out for Christ. Help me say.
Pass me not, O gentle Savior.
Hear my humble cry. In the back, come on, y'all.
Pass Me Not. That was one of the songs in Amen Corner that Lorraine Hansberry did a stage reading on, see, a couple of years ago now, when the National Black Theater does one play, one day, and this was the play for that particular year. The announcement is the 5th annual concert and tribute to African American composers. It's been going on for the past 5 years on the last Sunday of January, presenting these concerts at Eastside College Preparatory School in the Performing Arts Center. And the proceeds for these ticket sales go to the school, a remarkable private school that has been featured on 60 Minutes and on the most recent cover of the Palo Alto Weekly. This year they feature a tribute to the memory of Trayvon Martin and an original composition by nationally acclaimed jazz pianist Valerie Capers in tribute to Ruby Bridges, who, when just 6 years old, integrated the public schools in New Orleans. Dr. Capers will not only attend the concert, but she will perform with the ensemble. The website is aacinitiative.org, and you can see all of the various African American composers whose amazing music this school fundraising concert has featured in past concerts. The concert on Sunday, January 26th, this Sunday, is at 3 p.m. at the Performing Arts Center, 1041 Myrtle Street, Eastside College Preparatory School, East Palo Alto, California. Tickets are on sale, as seating is limited. Advance purchase is highly recommended. So the website is aacinitiative.org/upcoming.php. But I'm pretty sure you could just go to aacinitiative.org and find out all the information. The tickets are available at Brown Paper Tickets. So it sounds really fabulous. There's too much happening on Sunday. But you can definitely do both. You can go to the concert, and I'm sure you'll have time to get back and check out Miss Pat's house also on Sunday at 7 p.m. at the Pena Cultural Center in Berkeley, 3105 Shattuck Avenue. Should be really fun. And you're going to be able to hear it broadcast live on Wanda's Picks Radio. We're going to do a special broadcast, and I just had to find somebody to do that for me. So in the meantime, have a wonderful revolutionary day. Looking forward to seeing you in the theater tonight, perhaps, at Dance Brigade's performance of their latest work, Hemorrhage, at Dance Mission. And, yeah, it's just all so wonderful and all so good. And just keep moving, and things will work themselves out for sure, for sure. Peace and blessings. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Wanda's Picks.